I go, you know, we're not on TV to show.
Yeah.
You do the cross.
Yeah.
And say, Lord, have mercy on me.
Yeah. And that's it. Confession. Do confession.
And you confession.
Yeah.
You go to a priest, you confess. You know, yeah. This is a totally different subject.
Yes.
But back to what? Because we're talking about sincerity.
Yes.
The purity of intention. Mm. If you are pure, if you are purified in the set of your thinking, mm. and you're trying to be sincere about following one particular guy or leader, which you're supposed to.
Yes.
After, is it possible that Jesus, peace be upon him, did not tell the caravan? Listen to me.
Yes, right.
Didn't tell the caravan that from now on, okay? Mm. Because you talk about how many years?
570.
500 some years, okay? The next leader supposed, and he did. Mm. And Jesus, peace be upon him, introduced the next leader or the next guy.
Yeah.
Which we believe that is the Prophet of Islam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahu.
Dr. Hussain, I think it's worth you mentioning that ayah from the Quran that starts from Hazrat Adam, that I created this man as a representative of myself on earth, that this is in the Arabic language a continuous system.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's not something that was the earth is absent of.
Mm-hmm. That's true. But I didn't finish the point.
Yeah,
yet.
Yeah, but please finish that.
The finishing point is this, okay? If we're just talking about what common sense
says, yes.
Okay, the purity. If you are purified, that means you are connected to the source.
Yes.
Therefore, your intention is good. Mm. Your intention is okay. It can provide you all the good things.
Yes.
Because you are connecting to the real source.
Sure.
Therefore, you are sincere because you don't have to lie.
Mm.
And because you truly want to go from A to B without any damage.
Sure.
So on the way, you listen to whoever the guy tells you. You know, my argument is this.
Mm.
If you are sincere, you are see yourself limitless. You are see yourself powerful. Because you are connected to the source.
Exactly.
And if you are abandoned in the middle of the way,
yeah.
You're not going to get nowhere.
No, you will be lost.
The point is this, like it or not, we can, you know, sit here and argue forever.
Mm.
But we're not trying to, you know, waste our time.
Mm.
Because any argument has to have an aim, a goal. We're trying to reach a point of learning about the truth. You know what truth is? In Arabic, they call it haq.
Haq, yes.
The mere translation, brother, for haq is something constant.
Something stable.
Something is stable.
Mm.
Something you can count on.
On. Yes.
Something you can count on. Quite. Let's start simple.
Quite.
Okay? You can count on Allah because He has the power.
Yes.
He has the knowledge.
Mm.
He's wise.
Mm.
Okay? And He doesn't do anything baseless.
Yes.
Without any goal, without any aim.
And the point being here that the guidance, this guidance, this spirituality, this purity of intention and truth lies with some special people.
Exactly. Now back to the issue of Imam Khomeini.
Because we have to put it into that context.
He was pure.
Yes.
Because he was connected to the source.
Exactly.
And source is, brother, another argument.
Yes.
Another debate.
Yes.
Source is not too many.
No.
It's not so many. It's only one.
One. Because the principle of Tawheed.
You know, there is a verse in Quran.
Mm.
If there was two gods, most surely you would see the corruption.
Yeah.
Because every God, you know.
Yes, yes.
The assumption is this.
Yes.
God is limitless, okay?
Mm.
God is powerful, and God does whatever He wants, okay? Imagine two gods.
Mm.
He wants to go this way, the other one wants to go that way. That's corruption.
Yeah.
Corruption in true sense, we're talking about. We're not talking about corruption. It means something that is not. It's supposed to be on the place and is not.
Let me put it this way,
Doctor. And the place is the source.
Yeah, let me put it this way, Dr. Hussain, that the main thing is it's not even a question of us even debating the fact that there is one or two gods. The problem is our thinking,
mm-hmm.
our imagination of what we think.
The fantasies we're going
fantasy
through.
Of
the
what
daydreaming.
The daydreaming of what we think is our existence.
Exactly.
That is the problem, because at the end of the
and
day...
And this is a serious problem for humankind through the history.
Because what I want to get to is the fact that it's not the fact that people don't believe in God. Everybody believes in God.
But you have to prove it with your actions.
No. The thing is that Islam teaches us how to think about
exactly,
that God.
The means of.
The meaning of that God.
Exactly.
Exactly.
This is what I meant by giving you the example of the caravan and the leader.
Exactly. And this is what Imam Khomeini brings.
Same thing goes with
to
brother,
us.
This is very important while we're on the subject.
Yeah.
Same thing goes with the when you talk about the history of Islam, true Islam.
Yes.
We only have one Islam.
Mm.
We don't have so many of them.
Yeah.
The story goes with what happened after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Yes.
Same thing. Hey, caravan got to that point after 20 years of hardship that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, went through.
23 years. Yes.
You know, 10 years in Mecca and 13
years
after migration to Medina.
Yes,
after Hijra.
Yes.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Is it feasible?
Mm.
This is my question to you.
Yeah.
I need you to elaborate on this.
Sure, sure.
Because it's not, you know, that I say so.
Mm.
We're talking about reasoning here, logic.
Yes.
Is it feasible to think that at this particular point of the caravan of Muslims at the time, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, brought him to this point and said, hey, after here, you're on your own. Is it feasible to think?
No.
This is my question.
No, it's not.
I'd like to hear more from you.
Well, the thing
what
is...
What happened?
Well, I mean, we don't need to go far.
You talk about sincerity in intention.
No, we don't need to go far because...
talk about purity in intention and sincerity.
Yeah, we don't need to go far because the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, even in that 13 years, while he was in Medina... establishing the principles and the foundations of the Tawheed of Islam, he points out two things, two very important things that he keeps emphasizing on. There are so many...
On so many different occasions.
Yeah, occasions.
And in one particular one, in detail, that everything is written about it. And so many different narrations talking about it.
I mean, the thing is that at the end of the day, we have so many verses in the Quran which refer to this point, that... He says in a tradition that my family, these infallibles, these 12 infallibles, holy infallibles who will follow after me, they are the ship of the Ark of Nuh.
Mm-hmm. This is only example.
This is only
in
example.
Order to think.
You think, but the Quran says, the Holy Quran says, in the after the last khutbah is given in the Hajj, it's given to him as an order that say to them now,
that if you don't do that...
If you don't do this particular
thing...
It's
just like you didn't do the whole thing.
You didn't do the whole thing. And I'll save you from the kafirun.
Mm-hmm.
The
I
word
protect
is,
you.
Yeah, I protect
this
you
is
from...
What, you're talking about source... Brother, let me tell you this.
Yeah.
What happened after Prophet? Where did they go wrong?
Exactly.
What went wrong? Because they disconnected themselves from the source because of...
Mm.
Look at the mentality.
Yes.
Because they felt like they don't need it.
Yeah, they felt
the same thing happened with Christianity Jewish faith.
Excuse me, may I make that quote? What does it say in Arabic? They say that the Holy Quran is enough for us.
Hasbuna kitab Allah.
Hasbuna kitab.
Quran is enough for us.
Yeah.
But Quran has to have a teacher,
according
to the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Yeah.
This is the story of very good, important subject and significant at the same time. Purity of intention and sincerity. When you're connected to the source, let's summarize it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you see yourself with someone who knows what's going on.
Dr. Hasni, thank you very much for that. And as I say, I hope the listeners have enjoyed our discussion about the great holy personality of Imam Khomeini, God bless him. And there are so many dimensions still to be discussed. We've just, as I say, we've just scraped the surface. We haven't even done anything yet. But let's carry on in the next session and talk more about
God these, willing, we'll do
yeah,
that.
With the, inshallah, with the more aspects of this great personality. But it's enough for me to say at this moment in time, thank you very much for listening.
You are more than welcome.
May the peace and blessings of Allah and mercy be upon you all. Thank you and goodbye.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه.
Ravi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Ravi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ravi English Radio.
In the limelight.
Due to their skill and provocative nature, the annual U.S.-South Korea combined exercises have long been a trigger point for heightened military and political tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Anne Wright, former U.S. diplomat. This article is published under the heading, "For peace with North Korea, Biden must end the U.S.-South Korea military exercises." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. One of the thorniest foreign policy challenges the Biden administration will need to face is a nuclear-armed North Korea. Talks between the U.S. and North Korea have been stalled since 2019, and North Korea has continued to develop its weapons arsenal, recently unveiling what appears to be its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. Actions by the U.S. military can exacerbate tensions that lead to war. That's why the U.S. and South Korea must end combined U.S.-South Korea military exercises. Due to their skill and provocative nature, the annual U.S.-South Korea combined exercises have long been a trigger point for heightened military and political tensions on the Korean Peninsula. These military exercises have been suspended since 2018, but General Robert B. Abrams, commander of U.S. Forces Korea, has renewed the call for the full resumption of the joint war drills. U.S. and South Korean defense ministers have also agreed to continue the combined exercises, and Biden's Secretary of State nominee, Antony Blinken, has said suspending them was a mistake. Rather than acknowledge how these joint military exercises have proven to raise tensions and provoke actions by North Korea, Blinken has criticized the suspension of the exercises as an appeasement of North Korea. And despite the failure of the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign against North Korea, not to mention decades of U.S. pressure-based tactics, Blinken insists more pressure is what's needed to achieve North Korea's denuclearization. In a CBS interview, Blinken said the U.S. should build genuine economic pressure to squeeze North Korea to get it to the negotiating table. Unfortunately, if the Biden administration chooses to go through with the U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises in March, it will likely sabotage any prospect of diplomacy with North Korea in the near future. heighten geopolitical tensions and risk reigniting a war on the Korean Peninsula, which would be catastrophic. Since 1950s, the U.S. has used the military exercises as a show of force to deter a North Korean attack on South Korea. To North Korea, however, these military exercises, with names such as Exercise Decapitation, appear to be rehearsal for the overthrow of its government. Consider that these U.S.-South Korea combined military exercises have involved the use of B-2 bombers capable of dropping nuclear weapons, nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and submarines equipped with nuclear weapons, as well as the firing of long-range artillery and other large-caliber weapons. Thus, suspending the U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises would be a much-needed confidence-building measure and could help restart talks with North Korea. At a time when the world is facing urgent humanitarian, environmental, and economic crises, the U.S.-South Korea military exercises also divert critically needed resources away from efforts to provide true human security through the provision of health care and the protection of the environment. These joint exercises cost U.S. taxpayers billions of dollars and have caused irreparable injury to local residents and damage to the environment in South Korea. On all sides, the ongoing tensions on the Korean Peninsula have been used to justify massive military spending. North Korea ranks first in the world in military spending as a percentage of its GDP. But in total dollars, South Korea and the United States spend vastly more on defense, with the U.S. ranking first in military spending worldwide. That is about $732 billion, more than the next 10 countries combined. And South Korea ranking 10th, that is about $43.9 billion. By comparison, North Korea's entire budget is just $8.47 billion as of 2019, according to the Bank of Korea. Ultimately, to stop this dangerous, expensive arms race and remove the risk of renewed war, the Biden administration should immediately reduce tensions with North Korea by working to resolve the root cause of the conflict, the long-standing 70-year-old Korean War. Ending this war is the only way to achieve permanent peace and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome to the subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of the subcontinent, we will walk through the Khaf-Herat Railway and explore the consequences of the strategic line for the future of trade and transit across Asia to the Western world.
Recently, Iran sent its first cargo of exports to Afghanistan via the new Khaf-Herat Railroad as a trial dispatch to detect possible technical problems and issues on the 220-kilometer-long route of the Iran-Afghanistan Rail Corridor. This is a part of a long sought rail network which is planned to go from Iran to Afghanistan and China, either directly or through Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, facilitating transport of goods and services to Europe and the Western world.
The Khaf-Herat Railway was inaugurated with a trial freight train that delivered about 500 tons of cement from Iran to Afghanistan, while a passenger train also took Iranian officials to Afghanistan for a meeting. The Khaf-Herat line is part of a bigger east-west railway corridor project which extends from China to Europe through Iran and Afghanistan. The railway connects Iran's eastern city of Khaf near Mashhad to Afghanistan's western city of Ghorian in the Herat province.
This is a very important project, this new railway connecting the two countries, for a variety of reasons. Of course, economically, but also it demonstrates to the world that despite the U.S. aggression against both countries, progress still proceeds. This is a significant achievement. And this gives people hope, for one thing, but it also shows the rest of the world that despite foreign aggression, progress continues to be made. The government of the people continues to work on their behalf as much as it can, despite the opposition from outside forces, and it does so successfully, caring for the people. Certainly, Afghanistan is riddled with problems because of the U.S. war against it. But this will give hope to people and provide them with many more opportunities in a variety of ways, not only economically, but also in being able to do some additional travel and leave their war-torn area at least for a time. This provides hope to the people as well as a number of economic benefits.
The Khaf-Herat Railway was mainly implemented by the Islamic Republic of Iran under a tripartite agreement between Iran, Afghanistan and India.
You better know that Afghanistan is a water scarce and transportation roads can work as a backbone of the country, considering the fact that Afghanistan has an unsafe situation through the standard transportation system prevalent across the world. Goods can be transported through railways safely.
Under construction since 2007, the million-dollar project consists of four sections, two of which are in the Iranian territory and the other two on the Afghan side. Iran and Afghanistan have also signed a memorandum of understanding with five other countries that are on the way of the east-west corridor, including Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, and further negotiations are still ongoing in this regard.
During the inauguration ceremony, the presidents of both countries hailed the project as a way to increase trade and transit across the region. As Iran's sixth border railroad with neighboring countries and first with Afghanistan, the train track will connect Afghanistan to Iran's large rail network, further strengthening the bond between the two countries and helping Afghanistan become the transit crossroad it has dreamed of so long for becoming.
Speaking during an inaugural ceremony held via video conference due to the COVID pandemic, authorities and officials from Iran and Afghanistan described the railroad as a significant step toward creating a more robust network of international trade and transit of goods. President Rouhani called it a historic day in relations between the two great nations of Iran and Afghanistan and expressed hope that the project serves as a framework for more infrastructure development and economic investment.
It will have a significant impact on prospects for economic, social, and cultural exchange in the region. For one thing, the new railway is expected to transport as many as 1 million passengers between the two cities a year and up to 6 million tons of goods a year. The possible economic benefits for both nations is really beyond what we can comprehend almost. It's incalculable. This will allow Afghanistan to receive many more goods and services at a reduced price, goods and services that they need, goods, equipment, building equipment. Just recently, one of the first shipments was 400 tons of cement that's desperately needed in that nation. So as far as economically, they'll be able to trade much more easily with several ports in Iran. It will enable them to have proximity to a variety of different sources for goods in Iran. Additionally, this will give incentive to Afghanistan, to the Afghanistan government, to extend the railway within their country and connect with other nations. Afghanistan, of course, is landlocked and must move its goods either by road, by truck, or by rail. So having an efficient railway system connecting the two countries will encourage further not only trade and cultural exchanges, but also will encourage the nation to expand and extend the railroad. The opportunities for travel, for having even academic exchanges, sporting goods exchanges, and so on, greatly increases. So from a cultural viewpoint, there is that advantage, and people being able to just visit. So socially, economically, and culturally, this railroad has many, many advantages for both nations, and especially for Afghanistan, which, as I mentioned before, has been decimated by U.S. war for 20 years.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif noted that the Khav-Herat Railway's significance is not only for Iran and Afghanistan, but for the greater region. As a gateway that will boost trade and people-to-people exchanges, it will also contribute to regional stability and development. Turning our frontiers into bridges is a priority, the Iranian top diplomat said. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, for his part, called the project a historical plan that is crucial for trade and economic development throughout the region. Ghani noted that completion of the Khav-Herat Railway during the pandemic era is an indication of both sides' strong national determination. Underlying the significance of the railway, Ghani called it the starting point for the revival of foreign trade and economic development in Asia.
To me, as a citizen, the railway line can have many benefits to the development of the country's economy. For instance, we can name the Herat-Khav railway line that can prevent corruption in some of the departments, especially those on the border, and will minimize delay in transporting goods. We are hopeful that the Afghan government takes effective steps in expanding other routes just like this Herat-Khav railway network.
According to experts and officials, the Khav-Herat railway is important not only for Iran and Afghanistan, but also for the greater region, as it can complete a continental line of transport from the Oriental world to the West. The ultimate plan is to make Afghanistan connected to all parts of Asia, including the subcontinent, the Iranian plateau, and the Arabian Peninsula, even the North American plate in Siberia.
Before the opening of the Khav-Herat Railway, Afghanistan had three railroad lines but no passenger rail service. The first is between Mazar-e-Sharif and the border town of Haritan in Balkh province, which then connects with the railway network of Uzbekistan. This part is online since 2011. The second track, which links Turgundi in Herat province to Turkmenistan, is working since 1960. The third, which opens in 2016, is between Akina in Faryab province and neighboring Turkmenistan. The rail link from Herat to Khav is planned to transport both cargo and passengers, heralding a new era of transportation for the people of Afghanistan.
It has the potential to greatly change and enhance and improve their lives. As it is now, transportation from one area to another is very difficult because of the bombings, the U.S. troops and so on that are there, and the extreme poverty that the country suffers from, mainly because of the U.S. war. Having a railway through the country will enable people to travel to more peaceful parts of the country, enable them to visit relatives, perhaps who they haven't been able to see in some time because of the war and the inability to travel. Having easy transportation to different parts of the country will enable them to access different markets. This will benefit the people who are buying, but it will also benefit the people who are selling. So the ability for the Afghan people to travel within the country and between Afghanistan and Iran will bring many, many benefits to them, and that will cause significant positive changes in their lives.
Moreover, Afghanistan and India are working on extending the rail route from Herat to Mazar-e-Sharif. Mazar-e-Sharif is already linked with Uzbekistan and Tajikistan via rail routes. Herat is already linked with Turkmenistan via rail and road routes. India is also finalizing a plan to construct a 900-kilometer railway line that will connect the southeastern port of Chabahar in Iran to the mineral-rich Hajigarh region of Afghanistan.
Although the Afghan government is struggling with economic challenges and the war among militant groups, government itself, and the U.S.-led troops, it is committed to priorities such as the national flagship development, transportation, and infrastructure projects, and is especially determined to deliver the railway projects on time. Kabul knows that connecting the industrial park in Herat province with global markets will create many facilities for imports and exports, as it costs much less to transport goods by railway than by road, and it also takes less time to reach the destination.
Railways are the backbone of the economy in every country, and Afghanistan, as a landlocked country, is in urgent need of nationwide rail lines that would help connect Afghanistan to international waters through the neighboring countries.
I'm a resident of Herat. With regard to Herat-Khaf railway line, jointly developed by Afghanistan and Iran, it can be good for people-to-people contact as well as export and import between the two countries. It will also provide works to the people. I appreciate this Herat-Khaf railway link.
In addition to direct economic benefits of a national rail grid, railroad development projects can create thousands of jobs for the unemployed and for young educated Afghans, most of whom have to look for employment in neighboring or Arab countries.
About the Herat-Khaf railway line, it would create jobs for us, would prevent corruptions at customs on the border, and would boost import and export.
Once completed, the Khaf-Herat link will have the reported capacity to transport 6 million tons of goods and 1 million passengers annually. This would help Iran and Afghanistan create a vast transit hub between Europe and Asia, through which commercial goods and passengers can reach from the farthest parts of Asia to the ports of the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman.
Afghanistan and Iran are located very strategically for that purpose. And as they become a hub for trade between Asia and Europe, it will increase their economy greatly. It will give them both more stature in the Middle East and in the world. Afghanistan, of course, has been beleaguered for years. Iran is a powerful nation that has suffered economically due to U.S. aggression, but has stayed strong. Being a central hub for trade between a significant part of the world, economically, the Asia-European trade is extremely large. And with products being able to be shipped more efficiently and therefore more inexpensively, with Iran and Afghanistan as the hub, this will change the economic equation in the world, giving more importance to Europe and Asia, and decreasing their reliance on North American products that they need on a regular basis.
Strengthening the position of Iran and Afghanistan in the east-west corridors, the Khaf-Herat Railway may be the key to revive the ancient Silk Road trade routes and help China materialize its ambitious Belt and Road Initiative.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now Now, to add more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Shakil Ahmed Rameh, who's a political economist. Mr. Rameh, welcome to the subcontinent. So, what is the significance of the Khawf-Herat railway project? Why is it so important for the region?
So, it is important because any initiative for the connectivity to enhance the economic opportunity or create some opportunity for people-to-people connection is always a good. It brings with it own dynamics and own opportunities, which in the long term benefit the people and largely in the people and the governments of the both countries which are connecting.
So you mean it will bring economic, social and political opportunities. Could you elaborate more on the economic aspect? How will the Khawf-Herat railway change the prospects for trade in the region?
Definitely, it is a new avenue for Afghanistan and Iran to connect, and it will also an avenue where the other regional countries and the beyond the region countries can also connect. For example, India can also be connected with it through the Chabahar and creating some other linkages. It will also open the new opportunity for India. But it also can create opportunities if this railway road is being connected to the east-west railway corridor. That would be a very key question, because right now the China and Kazakhstan and other countries are talking to Afghanistan and Iran. Iran and Afghanistan looking at the opportunity how to connect it to the east-west corridor. If it is connected to the east-west corridor, that will open a new, era of development for the region and beyond the region. And also it will open opportunity for Afghanistan specifically, which has been hit by so many problems for the long time. It will also create some, the concrete linkages with the Europe and other countries where they can benefit through the trade. And Afghanistan definitely can trade in the different products. They have a different products to offer, especially in the form of the different fruits and dry fruits and also some minerals. So, but the fundamental question would be again, how it will be connected to the east-west corridor, one thing. Second thing, so how the Russia will take the next step. Because we know that the Russians already have constructed some railway in the Afghanistan-Uzbekistan border. How they will, either they are going to connect it to Afghanistan, either they are going to connect it independently, or they are going to connect, they create some linkages with this Khawf-Herat railway road. If they are going to build the connection with the Khawf and the Herat railway road, definitely it will also create some opportunities. But more important would be how Iran and Afghanistan work with the regional country to create to go for the cooperation. From my perspective, if Iran and Afghanistan go for the cooperation, then it can be a real game changer. If they are not cooperating, or if they want to take it to the solo flight, it will be, I don't think so, there will be some success, because Pakistan also have its edge through the CPEC, and if you look at Spain, Baltic, Pakistan can also go for connection with Afghanistan, and it would be shorter route. And again, China is building CPEC in Pakistan. They're from Kashgar to the Pakistan. They're bringing the routes and now working on the railway links. So that's why I suggest Iran and Afghanistan will have to cooperate and looking for the cooperation with the regional countries to make it a success.
Mr. Rameh, please let's just take a quick look at how the global media has covered the situation.
The Khawf-Herat Railway has a total of 218 kilometers in four sections, the first and second sections of which are from Khawf to Shamtir in Iran, with a length of about 76 kilometers, and the third section is from Shamtir to Ruznak, with a length of 62 kilometers in Afghanistan. This international railway has an annual capacity of 1.8 million tons of cargo transit from the Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, countries, Turkey and the Persian Gulf, said Iran's Deputy Roads and Urban Development Minister Said Rasouli. The Asian Development Bank has conducted a credible analysis on railways in Central Asia Regional Economic Cooperation countries, which include Afghanistan, with regards to their huge investment potential between 2017 and 2050, President Ghani said. Based on this study, Afghanistan needs to build 2,440 kilometers of railway, and the initial estimate for building 1,295 kilometers of railway is more than $2.2 billion, he said. The Khaf-Herat Railway will contribute to the development and strengthening of economic, social and cultural relations between Iran and Afghanistan by facilitating the export and import of goods and the transport of passengers between the two countries. It will provide Afghanistan the rail access through Iran and further to the international market, including southern access to maritime transport, including to Caucasus, Turkey, Iraq and Europe. The line is part of the East-West Rail Corridor, linking the transport network of China to Europe through Iran and Afghanistan. Local officials estimate that Afghanistan can import 2 million tons of goods annually from Iran via the Khaf-Herat link. Besides freight, the railway will also carry passengers. According to the spokesman for Afghanistan's finance ministry, the project also will reduce Kabul's dependence on Islamabad for trade. It will more than anything reduce reliance on Pakistan. It's part of our regional connectivity mega plan. Afghanistan needs affordable and connected transportation for its economic growth and trade balance. Railways offer that platform. We can connect not only with Iran, but also the wider region, he said.
Welcome back, Mr. Rome, and welcome back to the audience as well. Mr. Rome, you earlier mentioned that it is important to look how the East and West could be connected with this corridor. Now, with this rail line, Iran and Afghanistan are set to become the transit hub for all the exports from China, India, and all the countries along the way to Europe. What are the implications of this for the future of trade in Asia and Europe?
Look, as I said already, if we are going to take Khaf and the Herat Railway Road as a new hub of, you can say, the transit trade, so we have to look at the dynamics. As I mentioned already, if this would be able to create linkages with the East and West Railway Corridor, then it can be. And we also have to look the middle corridor, which is being under construction in Central Asian states by the Turkey. So how Turkey is going to build these connections with other corridors. If Herat and Khaf is able to build a connection with them, we have to look at that. Then the important question would be, if we are talking about from India to bringing it to Afghanistan and taking it to, you can say, the Europe or from other destinations, we have to also look at the economic cost. Because when you go to approach a market, you also have to be the competitive. Will India be able, if India is bypassing Pakistan and connecting directly to the this corridor to the Afghanistan and the Central Asian states, so what would be the economic cost? For example, the travel, what would be the travel cost? Will they be able to compensate if there's some other commodities are coming from other countries which don't have such huge economic, you can say, the travel cost? That would be another factor. And the last factor, again, which I already emphasized in my first point, so we have to look how they are building the connection, the cooperation with existing different corridors, or you can say different routes. If they are just bringing it like that, oh, this is everything is going to change, every dynamics will be going to change after that. That would be the question we need to ponder more seriously, especially when we're talking about it from Herat, if we want to bring it to the Kashgar, to the China. So what would be the economic cost to build that corridor? So what would it be the easier for the Chinese market to come from that route to reach to the Iran or Afghanistan or some other routes they are more feasible for them? One thing, a second thing, which we have to discuss here. So Iran would also be look at that, how they can connect it to the Middle East, because at this point of the time, the development status of Afghanistan, maybe they will be in a better position to tap the Middle Eastern economy, because they need the food and they can export the food. They need some minerals, they can export those minerals. And we have to look at that, how this road can also facilitate to create the linkages with the Middle East. Again, I will end my answer here. So we need cooperation, and we have to look how Iran and Afghanistan, they are using this railroad network to create the cooperation among the countries.
And that was our episode about the Herat-Khaf Railway and different aspects of it. We'll meet next week.
Epic. Glory. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
غیرت شو غزل غزل آی بنو از ابتدا تا انتها مردمی از جنس غرور
See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
In the limelight.
Republican Party leaders will meet with extremist Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene next week as an ongoing crisis over her racist and bizarre political views continues to roil American politics. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Republican Leaders to Meet with Marjorie Taylor Greene Amid Calls for Removal. Stay with us for more. Republican Party leaders will meet with extremist Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene next week as an ongoing crisis over her racist and bizarre political views continues to roil American politics. Meanwhile, Marjorie Greene tweeted on Saturday that she had had a phone call with former President Donald Trump, which she described as great, and that she was so grateful for his support, probably cementing her position as a champion of the far-right Trumpist wing of the Republican Party. Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has in the past expressed support for the racist QAnon conspiracy movement, has been the subject of a number of media reports revealing her past posts on social media that support or promote a range of fringe, violent, and bigoted ideas. Some important outside groups have demanded the Republican Party condemn her, and Democrats are pushing for Greene's removal from Congress, or at the very least, that she be taken off the important committees that she's been given positions on. Kevin McCarthy, the Republican House leader, will now sit down for a conversation with Marjorie Taylor Greene next week, his office said. But Republican leaders have so far offered no meaningful condemnation of Greene or indication that we'll take any action against her. Greene herself has remained angrily defiant in the face of the criticism, though her Facebook profile has had many posts removed. I will never back down, I will never give up, she said in a statement on Friday, 29th of January. Since arriving in Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene has become a symbol of how far to the right much of the Republican Party has moved under Donald Trump, and the continued influence of extremists in its ranks, especially after the 6th of January attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob. Democratic Congresswoman Cori Bush said on Friday she is moving her office away from Marjorie Taylor Greene due to safety concerns after Greene and her staff berated her and refused to wear face masks. Cori Bush told MSNBC she is moving her office not because I'm scared of Greene, because I'm here to do a job for the people of St. Louis. What I cannot do is continue to look over my shoulder, wondering if a white supremacist in Congress, by the name of Marjorie Taylor Greene, is conspiring against us, she said. Calls for action against Greene have grown louder as more and more reports have emerged of her extreme views. In past social media posts uncovered by CNN, Marjorie Taylor Greene indicated support for executing Nancy Pelosi, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton. In a 2018 Facebook post reported by Media Matters, she echoed conspiracy theories that the wildfires that ravaged California that year were caused by a laser beam from outer space, triggered by a group of Democratic politicians and companies for financial gain. In a 2019 confrontation with survivors of the Parkland mass shooting, documented on tape, she appeared to accost the students and later echoed conspiracy claims that mass shooting survivors and family members of victims are crisis actors, and that attacks that killed their loved ones were staged as a plot to pass gun control laws in the United States. Some of Marjorie Taylor Greene's views embrace anti-Semitic tropes, and that has prompted some Republican Jewish groups to speak out against her. The Republican Jewish Coalition said on Friday it is working with PAC leaders on next steps and noted that it opposed Greene's 2020 election because she repeatedly used offensive language in long online video diatribes and promoted bizarre political conspiracy theories. Meanwhile, the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, which includes major conservative Jewish lobby groups like IPAC and American Friends of Likud, among the 53 Jewish groups it represents, issued a strongly worded condemnation and call for action against Marjorie Taylor Greene. The group said Greene was spreading baseless hate against Jewish people and called for a swift and commensurate response from political leaders. Elsewhere, the Human Rights Campaign has called for McCarthy to remove Greene from her committee assignments. There must be consequences for her actions. The Human Rights Campaign calls on House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to hold Marjorie Taylor Greene accountable and remove Representative Greene from all her assigned congressional committees at the very least, said Human Rights Campaign President Alfonso David.
Economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Ahway. For on this week's show, we will be looking at the situation in Britain that sees the children there going hungry as poverty strikes. Now, Britain prides itself as a modern, developed, and multicultural nation, claiming to have an excellent social service that's designed to maintain the needs and demands of its 66.5 million people. However, recent reports have painted a very different picture of the so-called land of hope and glory, as poverty kicks in harder than ever following the effect of the COVID-19 pandemic and more so, Brexit. Now, with around 25% of the population living in poverty and 4.5 million of them living in deep poverty, the most severely affected are the children, with Child Poverty Action Group showing that after housing costs have been calculated, just under 40% of British children live in poverty, according to IFS projections. Purple line here shows the after-housing costs. Now, taking the view on a broader scale, the End Hunger UK charity have published some truly alarming figures, suggesting that, for example, one in four parents have skipped a meal as they cannot afford to eat. Also, one in four parents worry about not having enough food to eat and feed their families. And one in eight people in Britain go a whole day without eating any food at all. Now, that's around 8.3 million people based on the entire UK population. Well, let's now take a look at our first report, which covers a recent story emerging from Britain covering free school meals provided to underprivileged children in Britain, studying the less than impressive food packages that parents are expected to feed their children with.
Please, sir, I want some more.
What?
Please, sir, I want some more.
What's embarrassingly reminiscent of orphanages in Victorian times? British children are facing hunger on a scale not seen since Charles Dickens wrote about Oliver Twist in his famous novel. Yet here we are in 2021, and with Britain undergoing the toughest of times in its economic history as a direct result of the COVID-19 virus, and more worryingly, Brexit, the biggest victims of all the Tory government's failure are the children, with figures showing millions of them are now living in poverty in the towns and cities of Britain. With the country in its third lockdown, and figures showing that nearly 2,000 people are dying every day, the UK has had to react by closing down schools and learning facilities across the land. However, the problem does not lie in the children missing out on their education, as painful as that may seem. The biggest point is that for millions of British children, it means that they're missing out on their one square meal per day. As for those in poverty, food at home is nothing but a wishful dream. But it's not just the poorest families whose parents or guardians are out of employment that are suffering. As the economic situation in Britain becomes worse, parents who are in work are now finding things tougher than ever, as the purse strings grow ever tighter, meaning sacrifices have to be made.
We've had some people who were very in good jobs lose their jobs. And when they come to us, you can sense the stress and the anxiety, because they've always been able to provide for their families. They've never had to get the begging bowl out, so to speak.
For single parents or parents who are unable to work, the situation's even graver, with the United Nations rapporteur on poverty, Philip Alston, raising his concerns about how the people in Britain are slipping ever deeper into poverty.
I think the employment statistics are very impressive. I think poor people need to work when they can. But what we see is a huge amount of in-work poverty, and we see those who can't get work for whatever reason, because they're just not up to it, living in increasingly dire conditions.
So when Britain asked the government to vote on extending free school meals to underprivileged children during holidays and lockdown, the Tory government of Boris Johnson voted overwhelmingly to not provide the service, causing people to step in and take action, something that we'll touch on later on in the show. But what followed was a sham. Parents who started to finally receive emergency food packages took to social media to complain about the quality and quantity of food being sent to them, with many of them expected to feed their two children on half a tomato, half a pepper, a third of a carrot, and one potato for a whole week, something that children in the most impoverished nations in the world could have done better on, leaving the British government with egg on its face.
Joining me in the studio is Current Affairs and Impact Analyst Mahan Abedin and our special guest David Gordon, a professor of social justice and the director of the Bristol Poverty Institute at the University of Bristol. Mahan, welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let me first start with Professor Gordon. Many thanks, Professor Gordon, for joining us. First up, recent images on social media that I'm sure you've seen in the news, and that's the school emergency lunches. Many saying they're falling short of the standards that are expected. The complaints are that they cannot feed two children on the portions that are given. Why is the government then allowing standards to slip, and what are they doing to rectify the situation?
Well, Kaveh, that, of course, is a really important question. Thank you for inviting me on your show in order to discuss these issues. There, of course, is a major problem of an increase in inequality and of poverty in the UK and around the world because of the pandemic. So what we've found is that over the past year, about a third of households have reported a fall in income. And the Food Foundation did a survey in the summer which found that something like 5 million adults were now food insecure, which is more than double what it had been previously. And over the summer, when children were not in school because of the summer holidays, something like 11% of children reported that their families had to rely on food banks in order to supplement the amount of food they had. So there's a real problem because of the pandemic, and it's led to a